and welcome to the Steam Power Podcast. Chicka 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 chicka.
Hello and welcome to the Steam Power Podcast, episode number 57 for January 4th, 2015. We are a bi-weekly podcast dedicated to bringing you the latest and the greatest and the quirkiest in science, technology, engineering, art, and math news, as well as the makerspace movement and the open source movement. Steam Power, the power to change the world. I'm Mike.
I'm Lisa.
It's time to get
steamy.
Hello and welcome to the new year. Ding, ding.
Yeah, I'm impressed that you got the year right.
Oh, I did get the year right for once.
That's one of my, I think, I don't know if I'd call it a quirk, but every time I write the date on something after the new year, yeah, I put the wrong date. At least.
Well, when we used to write, we still write checks for certain
things. No, I do it on school things a lot school. Yeah.
Yeah. So, we had it a winner. We announced it on Twitter and Google Plus. The gentleman's name was Ray. And it was his email was photogrr.
Congratulations.
So congratulations. He's already called and claimed. His comment was for the new year, he was hoping to take his hobby of photography and turn that into at least a side job.
I think that's a very good goal.
Yeah, I think so too.
That's sort of what I did with my knitting last year with Super Chic Dallies.
Whoa, what was that? I look a little drunk there.
I was gonna say
a little drinky.
I think we both. I am tired, but not that tired. Good heavens!
I'm trying to get used to this. So I've got a new boom. Thank you, by the way, for Christmas.
Yes,
a little mic boom. The problem is that I have to look this way, so don't think that I'm not looking back at you as trying to be rude. I'm just trying to keep my voice into the microphone. So
we've been married for, 11 years now? I've gotten used to you being kind of rude.
11 years in a week. I have to remember, 12 days, 9 days.
Yeah, I was going to say 12 days. I don't think so.
And whatever. Subtraction or addition. So, yeah, I got to remember that. So make a note. Let me make a note here. Don't forget
the anniversary.
Anniversary. Because no matter what you say, I'll get my butt kicked. So that's a good use of technology. Set a reminder. Set it and forget it. All right. So let's go on and let's get started. Let me go over. The internet is acting a little wonky today. So bear with me. Bear with us. Bear with the machinery. So we guys always want to start off by thanking our sponsor, Audible.com. You can head over to get a free 30-day trial by visiting audibletrial.com/steampowerpodcast. You sign up and you'll get a free credit, which is good for one free download. And then afterwards, you'll be billed at $14.95 a month thereafter, which is will give you one credit every month as part of your membership, and that will give you access to over 150,000 audiobooks, and you can listen to them on all your favorite devices, be it Android, iOS, Windows Mobile, and of course Kindle. And so, you know, now that it's the new year.
Yeah, I'm going to read that Amy Poehler book, I think.
That's probably, I think people are having their New Year's resolutions. One of them could be get more edumacated, get more enlightened.
Or read more. I think that's always one of my more nobler resolutions that never pans out. But
but it's good. Like they say, I like the picture where they show it's like a gym in December, which is like nobody there. Gym in January. Everybody and their brother, gym in February looks just like the gym in December.
No, that's one of mine too, is to exercise more. I have a lot this year, I think.
I think.
I have a lot of goals this year.
Got goals this year. I think 15 will be an interesting, it'll be a good year overall. My gut.
Good.
So with that, we thank Audible for their patronage of the Steam Power Podcast, and we hope you pay them a visit as well. And with that, I've had this up. I've never really talked about it, So I want to actually put it out there for people, which is probably kind of stupid to do it after the holidays. But I was trying to prove that I'm not a purely capitalistic-driven egomaniac. So we have a little
Steam Power Podcast swag.
Swag over at Cafe Press. So if anybody who knows how this works is basically what I like about it is because we're not that big of a podcast that we can, I don't want to spend a lot of money on shirts and then just have inventory that I would, you know, just hold forever. And one day we probably, hopefully knock on wood sometime in 2015, we'll be there. But so in the interim, you can though go, there's a couple other services. I liked Cafe Press just because, it seemed easy and it was easy.
Now, can I ask, why doesn't it say Steam Power Podcast on any of the shirts?
Because I am a simplistic person who likes,
I understand that, but in the logo, you know, the spirit of advertising.
Yeah, I know. I'm not good at that. That's why I hired you this year. You got to fix me.
In the spirit of advertising, I honestly think maybe it should say Steam Power Podcast.
Right. I agree.
.com somewhere on there.
I'm
because people are, you know, our listeners maybe will look at the logo and know what it is, but people on the street are not going to know what that is.
See, I just want to believe that one day we'll be so famous that it'll be like the Apple logo.
Sure, one day.
You don't have to say Apple computer on the back.
But in order to get there, you need to advertise.
Yeah, this is true.
So I do think it should say, you know, it doesn't have to be big.
Not big. Small enough. I've got some ideas.
Maybe we need to retool that.
I'm interested in seeing how the...
So check out the swag page in a few days.
Let's retool that a little bit. Go to steampowerpodcast.com, look for the swag button. If you want to go there direct, it's cafepress.com/steampowerpodcast.
Where did that term come from anyway, swag?
I don't know. It's what I always
thought. Is that one of those internet things that
I've heard it long before that. Really? Like when I used to go to conferences where I still go to conferences.
You started hearing it a lot last year, though, swag. It was
Here's the way I remember the world. When you would go to conferences or trade shows, they would give out, and it was called swag. I think now that term, and maybe I'm wrong, this is the way I see it from the world. Now people that have websites and podcasts and YouTube channels that are somewhat famous that sell products have just taken that term to mean like
stuff.
Self-promotional goods and merchandise. I think merch is another. Merch.
I don't think I like that merch. One. No, I don't like merch.
It sounds like Merc. Or, yeah, Nart.
Merch. It just sounds like that weird cousin's name or something. Merch, you know? So,
anyway, merch. I agree. So, but I like the, I like it was clean. It's simple. For whatever reason, you put the mouse over every product, it goes right to zoom in the logo. But anyway, there's some male shirts. There's some female shirts. There's a button. There's a magnet. There's a mug. There's a trucker hat. And there's even a shirt for
And they infant. Definitely need to say Steam Power Podcast.
So and we'll work on that. We'll be some new ones in 2015. The other thing I just wanted to mention is we also set up a SoundCloud. I got some requests from people saying, hey, I listen to a lot of my stuff on SoundCloud.
Okay.
I think they're in the process of creating a – right. It was meant to be for like music distribution, like, you know, basement DJs and people that you know, for mixing their own stuff and wanted a way to distribute it. But they haven't really done much with audio in terms of the spoken word podcast and whatnot. I've seen things here and there. But so in the short term, basically you get 3 hours free with a free SoundCloud account, which for us is good for usually about 2 or 3 episodes. So I'll just keep the latest 2 or 3 episodes on SoundCloud, and you can visit our website if you want to go back.
So wait, is that every day you get, or is that once you log in?
No, so when you upload as many sounds as you want. Once you hit 3 hours of uploads, you have to delete your older stuff in order to upload.
I see. So we can only ever have like the newest 2 or 3 podcasts.
Until we get so famous that I won't mind spending whatever it is per month.
Okay. And the older ones are also always available at like Apple Podcasts and other things like that.
So I have it right now set up where the last 10 are kept on iTunes, which is, you know, that's 20 weeks worth. That's
where I listen to my podcasts at.
And then the whole catalog is backlogged on steampowerpodcast.com.
Okay. So there are other ways for them to listen to the older ones.
Yeah, I think it's just a matter of...
Well, some of the older ones don't have me, so...
The older ones don't have
me. I know. Some of them do.
Probably nobody wants to watch. So.
No, I don't say that.
Not when it's just me gabbing to myself. I'm just looking at this weird logo. Okay. Anyway, I should stop pressing buttons before I get in trouble.
All right, so...
So that's that, and if you want to go over and also support, you can hit up the Patreon page, which is at patreon.com/steampowerpodcast.
Why is it Patreon?
That's just the name of the company.
Not Patreon?
No, it's Patreon. I don't know why. Hmm. If you want to give a dollar, give $5.
I like how it says steamy podcast
steamy. Episodes. We produce steamy podcast episodes. They're very steamy.
Yes, I like that.
So you can we give, you know, if it's just a dollar a month, it helps. So you can check that out. All right, so let's get into our reviews of our things. This time I'm doing an ebook where you can get it as a book.
Okay.
But I'm reading it on my Kindle and I really like it. It's called The Innovators, How a Group of Hackers, Geniuses, and Geeks Created the Digital Revolution. It is written by Walter Isaacson, who did the Steve Jobs biography a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of shows what I really like about this one is it shows, you know, yes, we like to think that there are sole inventors sitting down in their basement that come up with every great idea. It's like it's one because we want to give credit to a person, right? Well, this book shows that it's not that simple, that innovation is actually a long process that's usually a series of small inventions that build on top of each other. And every now and then you have this spark of innovation. But for the most part, it's this long process. And it starts off and goes back into the 1800s with Ada Lovelace and Charles Babbage, who back, you know, when we had like the loom machines that used punch cards to direct mm-hmm. how to make looms. And they saw those and said, well, you know, how can we make these into more general purpose? And so they were thinking of computers as like mechanical devices, like steampunk looking things with gears and pulleys. And mm-hmm. they thought that's how computers were going to be. But a lot of the fundamental concepts they have were sound. It's just that it wasn't mechanical solutions weren't the answer. You would have to wait until electronics and electrical principles were better understood before their principles of what a computer was could really take shape. So it's a good story that shows that innovation. Like I said, it's not this lightning strike in all of, by this one guy or one gal in the basement. It's really a lot of things that build on top of each other over time.
It's a process.
It's not as quick as people think. It's speeding up. I mean, innovation is certainly speeding up. We're seeing more and more innovations per year, but the reality is where we got today was something that started, you know, 150, 200 years ago, if not longer. And, you know, yes, there were geniuses and there were guys that had good, right ideas that, you know, sparked someone else. But basically, you know, one person would have the great idea, the fundamental concept, but they didn't know how to actually create it or make it. And someone who needed to make stuff didn't necessarily have the great big picture thinking. And this book talks about all the teams that came together where you had the theorist and you had the pragmatic engineer and how they work together. And there's chapters, so there's talks about, again, it starts back with Charles Babbage and Ada Lovelace, who kind of laid the foundation of what computing would eventually become. Then it jumps into the World War II, where really computing really started with the ENIAC and the UNIVAC and trying to figure out missile trajectories and computers to break the Enigma machine with the German code machine. And then from there, it talks about the transistor, the microprocessor, video games, the internet. And that's where I'm at right now is a chapter on the internet. And what I really like about that is you know, even in my professional education, I'm aware of guys like Vint Cerf, Tim Berners-Lee, Vint Cerf, who's now at Google, but came up with the was with part of the team that invented the, it was called the TCP/IP protocol. Basically,
I've heard
the packets that go back and forth from the internet. He invented how that world works. So basically, taking a web page or any kind of data, breaking up into packets, and then routing that back around through routers was part of his contribution. And the ARPA, and his work with the ARPANET, which was at the U.S. Department of Defense initiative. And then Tim Berners-Lee over in Europe, as part of the guys that have done the Large Hadron Collider. I forgot the name of them now. Oh, shoot. You got to be kidding me.
Just say, don't look at me. Because if it's one thing I'm not good at, it's names.
I can't believe I cannot believe I'm brain farting on the...
That sucks, doesn't it?
The group. The Tim Berners... CERN. CERN. God darn it.
Oh, hey, I've heard of that.
CERN. The European Particle Physics
Laboratory. We did a story on that.
Yes. And so his contribution was HTML, Hypertext Markup Language, a way to make web pages so that data could, you know, could be easily and laid on top of the TCP/IP network. You know, here you have one thing, it's because the TCP/IP layer is kind of like, I'll think of it as like.
So did this guy invent the World Wide Web?
Again, so that's the great thing about this story is that.
Because that's what his biography says there.
I would say. Yes, it depends on, because there's, again, there's so many, the internet's not just this one thing. It's this
layer and it's not just one person. See, that's kind of.
But I would say that he gave birth to the idea of web pages.
Okay.
And be able to hype, and people had thought about hyperlinking before, but he actually created the solution that took hold, basically.
Okay.
So again, it's one of those things where, you know, was it an original thought completely? No. But did he come up with a practical solution that got widely adopted? Yes. And again, going back to this book, the Innovators, it paints that picture. It paints, and the discussion of who invented, I mean, every innovation, there's question of who do you really claim was the inventor? And that the chapter on the transistor had that question. The chapter on the microprocessor had that question. The chapter on the internet had that question. And I'm on right next to that. I'm right on the chapter right now with the personal computer. And I'm sure I know that for a fact has a question.
I thought you said you were on the chapter with the internet.
Well, I literally just finished it.
Okay.
I'm two pages into the personal computer chapter.
Okay.
Anyway, it's a great book. One complaint that people have had about it, and I agree with them, is that it's a rather short book.
Mm-hmm.
So it's discussion. It's not a technical manual book. It's for the layperson kind of read. It's not meant to be. So it kind of goes quickly.
Well, it's a nonfiction type.
Right. Book. And my point is that because it's trying to do the entire history of computing, you know, from Charles Babbage, Ada Lovelace, up to where we are today, and everything in between, internet, video games. To make it interesting and keep people wanting to read it, it is kind of at a superficial layer. But my point is, if you get to a chapter that you particularly enjoy, there's tons of other resources that you can dig down and find the really Nat's-ass details of a certain subject. But this
Nat's-ass details.
Tiny.
I have never heard that
before. Nat's-ass.
Okay.
So there you go. There's your lesson for today.
So if you want to know the Nat's-ass details of video games.
Google. But if you want to if you want to know where to start
I'm sure there's tons of books on the chapters in that book, too.
Exactly. And he's quoted all his sources. So if you're really interested in him getting more detail on a specific subject. But I think his book, Isaacson's book, is a good broad overview and a good place to start if you want to get an understanding of who the key players were and then go do more research. So that's my rant.
All right. Your rant, your review. My review this week would have to be on my wonderful Keurig that I got for Christmas. Was it 45 or something 40? Like that? 450? I'm not exactly sure. But it was called 45 or something. The 2.0. It's just, it does the one cup
and this is of coffee. A good technology discussion.
This is actually perfect for our household because I've gotten in my ripe old age of 35 to the point where I enjoy having one cup of coffee. Maybe I could go for two some days, but for the most part, one in the morning. And this makes the perfect little cup of coffee the flavored coffees. We got the chocolate flavor, we got vanilla, and we got caramel flavor. They're all good.
And
I like all of them. It heats up in literally a minute. The coffee's done in a minute. So you can go downstairs and within, I'd say, 2 or 3 minutes, have your cup of coffee ready. So I just start the coffee, start it heating up, get the cat's food or whatever. And by that time it's heated up, press the button. By the time I've, gotten something else out, the coffee's done.
I like it too. I'm not as big of a coffee drinker, but every now and then
it is so easy. And I'm somewhat of a boob with these kind of machines sometimes. This is literally boob proof. I mean, you would have to be a Neanderthal to not know how to operate this thing. It is just,
and I am a Neanderthal and I can use it. So.
It is just so easy, so simple, and it makes a great little cup of coffee.
And let's talk though real quick. So you said it's not a Keurig 2.0. So for
it's people, it's not a 2.0.
So,
and to tell you the truth, I don't know much of the difference except that the 2.0 is a bigger machine. I think it does hot water and coffee. Where this machine, although what would happen if you just didn't put a pod in there? Wouldn't it just put hot water down?
Would it? Yeah, if you didn't put
a pod of coffee in there.
You mean if you didn't put a little pod?
Yes, if you didn't. Pod.
Pod. I heard pod. I'm sorry. Pod. Yeah, I guess it would just pass. Unless there's a way to...
There's a sensor that it detects that.
There's nothing in there, yeah. But that's an interesting...
But also, what you said, the 2.0 has the sensor where it detects whether or not you put a Keurig pod in there.
It has DRM, what I would call it. Just like you have, like... You
and to me, that's just asinine that a coffee maker... has gone to that length of trouble to prevent knockoff coffee pods from being put in their machine. I mean, what
seems really anal, in my opinion. It's like,
is it a money making thing in your opinion, or is it a maintenance thing where the other pods could tear up the machine?
BS. No, it is pure and simple a money making thing. It's a way for them, because here's what they're doing.
I thought the Keurig pods that we got off of, they were pretty reasonable.
Yeah. So here's what they want to do. They want to go out to companies like Dunkin' Donuts,
Starbucks,
and get from them licensing rights. So basically, you want to put your coffee on our Keurig machine.
Which I do think they have some with Dunkin' Donuts, right?
They want to, yeah, they do. Yeah. And that's the point. So what they do is, it's in order to say that you can only, and here's what I'm waiting for, is someone else to invent a machine, a competitor that doesn't care what you put into it. And this all goes moot.
I think there is a machine, I forget what it's called, but I was actually reading on the Keurig today and it said something about not valid in Zio machines or something like that. So there must be some sort of Keurig knockoff that's similar, that their pods don't work in that particular machine.
So let me go into my technology.
All right. Here. So explain what it is that the Keurig pods, they had this little sensor on the top of the pod. Is that what it is?
So in the, up in here, in this,
a Keurig pod looks like a little coffee creamer pod, right, by the way.
Up in
and
here,
it has powder in it, which is the coffee.
Is basically a little RFID tag reader.
Okay.
And literally in every single, lid, that little tinfoil lid that you would, you know, if it was
a, you don't even peel it off, because there's a little needle that pokes a hole into it, and it pokes a hole through the bottom, and that's how it filters. Popped the microphone.
Popped your microphone. In that little, there's a little RFID chip. you know, they're mm-hmm. dirt cheap now to make. And so what you have is when you put the coffee pod in there and you clamp it down, it sits there and it the RFID tag reader pings out a little radio transmission. If there's a tag, it will return a signal back to it, and it goes, oh, yep, this is a valid Keurig improved. Go ahead and start making the coffee. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't get that, if it's a plain one and there's no tag, mm-hmm. it won't. It basically there's no return signal. Therefore, the little microcontroller doesn't.
Which I've got to say now, I haven't been looking. Obviously, I just got this for Christmas, and I haven't been looking at the pods all that much. But I haven't even came across any pods that weren't Keurig endorsed or whatever you want to say.
You can find them on the internet, certainly.
I mean, maybe like Walmart or somebody sells, but I mean, the ones we saw on Target were Keurig.
You know, here's where I get on my rant about making things consumer friendly. And if you treat your customers like criminals, you're going to encourage them. So, you know, here's, and especially in this thing, because it's so stupidly easy to break this system. So all you do is you take one real official Keurig pod, mm-hmm. peel the lid off, tape it up inside your thing.
Which that's got to be kind of hard to do because there's a needle up there.
Take some hot glue and stick it up there. All you need to do is get that device to get that little tag close.
And
to
wouldn't
the
tag that reader. Affect how the needle pokes the pod?
No, that's what I'm saying. You can just no.
I don't know. I'm always afraid to mess with things. Like I'm never going to be one to jailbreak my phone or anything like that. I don't mess with stuff.
See, I do.
I don't mess with things.
It's just stupidly easy. To break this.
Well, anyway, it wasn't a concern for us because we got that model anyway. But
yeah, so Keurig, do me a favor, trust your consumers, trust your customers. You know, because you know they'll say that. Yeah, I'm sure they'll go off and say.
I really don't think they're hurting for money that much that they needed people to buy the pods.
If we really care about our customers, and therefore we want to ensure that they get the best quality experience. If they use an off-brand, it may gum up the machine. No, if it was really the intent, they wouldn't care.
Then they'll go out and buy another
Keurig. Because they'd break, and then they'd go buy another Keurig machine. So they would want to endorse
because
that.
How many people, when your small appliance breaks, send it to the manufacturer for warranty? Yeah, nobody
does anymore.
Yes.
So anyway, do the right thing, Keurig. Keurig 3.0. Get rid of the DRM.
Is it 3.0 or 2.0?
I said when they do the 3.0.
Oh, okay.
Get rid of it. Go back to like it was in 1.0. Trust your consumers.
The 2.0 is just too big of a machine. I mean, we just didn't need that big of a. This one is perfect. Yeah. It's just perfect.
Anyway,
all right, better get on to the stories because we've been
gabbing. It's the new year. We're gabbers. there we go.
We've been kind of yakety yak today.
Yeah, I guess I should go right back to the go back. So I'm going to wave out of here and go back to the screen sharing real quick. Oh, if the internet will work with me. Please, internet, work. All right,
so we're on to our stories, right?
So scientist claims she has mathematical proof black holes do not exist. And so this is a
yeah. This one was kind of interesting. Research. What was the proof that they had before they did exist? Scientific. I thought they had.
We have had. Okay, so there's not, as far as I'm aware, and someone can correct me. Most black hole is mathematical proofs. It's mathematical based. Mm-hmm. There has been some research that has empirically detected the evidence. Or you know things in readings we would expect that if there were black holes, but the issue has been that there has been alternative explanations.
Okay.
That said, that so basically we found evidence that could be, but it's not the evidence that there's no other explanation other than black holes. So anyway.
So now they're saying they have proof that they don't exist.
Well, no. So now there is a mathematically proven. There's basically a way to explain how the universe came into being, how the universe is constantly
that doesn't use black holes.
That does not require black holes. It's okay. Purely a mathematical. But it's purely
mathematical. So, in other words, that title of this article is a little misleading then.
Scientists claim she is mathematical proof. Yeah, so I would write it as...
Because this is saying they could still exist. However, there's a chance that the universe could have been formed without
them. The way I would write this, and I'll find... There's a better link somewhere. I'll have to find the better story. But yes, there is basically saying mathematically, here is a set of equations that model the universe from its creation to now that does not rely on black holes as part of the explanation. Is it the true answer? No. No, any more, any, I'll put this way, any, insofar as, is it any more proven than the black holes? No. There is, again, there's some evidence. What I'd be curious is, here's this new proof. Does all the empirical research that we've done thus far that leads us to believe that, yeah, there are black holes, but we're not 100% sure, could you take that data, apply it to this model, and would you still get, you know, would it still be come out as truth, that the model would be backed up? Or is it saying, because if we take the empirical evidence we have and we apply it to her new proof and it falls apart, then... so that's okay. The thing is, right now, so this is what's cool about, you know, the intersection of physics and math. You know, a lot of what we say we understand to be true is based on models that we have created, and a lot of these models are mathematical based, that seem to represent and model the world as universe as we understand it. But until there's backed up by empirical, which is basically research, I mean, science experiments. You got to do an experiment, collect data, look at it. Does that mathematical model actually corroborate? Corroborate. I like that word. Corroborate. Or does it send you off on a different tangent?
Okay.
So I'd be curious to follow up with this article with that. Is can someone, you know, the data we've collected, you know, astrophysicists throughout the years, does that apply to this model and does it still jive? But I don't know. Okay. I need to do some more research. But I think it was a cool story.
Yeah. And we should not take so much time on our stories today since you have a little...
Oh, we do have a top thing. Five.
Yes.
Yeah.
Top five of 2014.
This is a quick one. So a couple this weeks is back... This is a cool
one, I think.
They needed a wrench up on the International Space Station. So what did they do? They emailed it, of course, right?
Because that's what everybody does.
That's what everyone does, yes. If you need a wrench, right? So what happened was a few months back, one of the resupply missions delivered a 3D printer to the space station. They needed to do they were doing an experiment up there like they do on the space station, which is pretty much all they do is experiments. They needed a wrench. They did, and one with the size, I guess, of a fitting that they didn't have up there. So a bunch of mechanical engineers sat down, designed it in CAD, and they emailed the file up to the space station.
And they printed it out.
And
I think that's just the coolest thing.
And there you go.
So next time you need a tool, you can just go to HomeDepot.com.
That's going to be the future.
Click on the pattern, download it to your computer right there, and print it right out instead of having you go to the store.
I think that's the future. I see that there's still going to be Targets and Walmarts.
Now,
and
when we can do that with food, I will be a happy lady.
Yes. And I think, I mean, NASA's working on that.
Because I hate grocery shopping.
NASA's working on
that. I hate it.
Here's the real cool thing, though. You can head over to NASA's website and download this file yourself and print it out yourself. You can download the wrench that NASA's used.
Well, that's neat. That's neat that they're making that available, because that's a really good story piece, I think, for kids, for school.
I agree.
Although most schools don't actually have a 3D printer. That'll be the next big thing, I think, is for schools to get 3D printers so that they can show kids they can do.
I agree. And I think this is a good story because... You know, we've been thinking about, like, you know,
that would be a good part of STEM education would be to have a 3D printer in school.
And that's why I really think, you know, today in the world we live in now, the Navy, when we go out to sea, you know, they carry a bunch of spares with them. And based on mathematical models, we take the right different number of parts that we think based on failures. You go, you know, this part fails a lot. This part doesn't fail so much. It will take more of these, less of these. Well, the Navy's already experimenting with, well, instead of taking a bunch of different parts that we may or may not need,
take the
raw material that you can use regardless of what part it is. Take a bunch of these 3D printers and then just print the parts as you need them and not have. Well, that's to me is, you know, how we're going to go to a space exploration. The question is, well, how do we take all the stuff that we need? Well, you don't. You take them, you have the necessities, the life support systems, blah, blah, blah. But in terms of all the other the support materials you want to take with you when you take this wagon train to the stars, instead of having to take all the parts, you just take this bunch of raw material. And as things break, you replace the parts that actually break instead of.
I can see like a lot of kids wanting 3D printer to print toys and things like that.
It's going to be huge. Yeah. It's going to be huge.
What do you think the next 5 years or so?
5 years.
It's going to blow up.
I think in the next 5 years, you will. I mean, there's already. So Dremel already has a 3D printer out there. It's $1,000. I think within the next 5 years, you'll be able to walk into Walmart. And for $200, buy a 3D printer.
So how long do you think it'll be before every household has a 3D printer like a computer? You know, because 20 years ago, people were thinking, we'll say 30 years ago. People were thinking, computers, they're way out of reach. Not everybody's going to have one. Now, you'll be hard-pressed to find a house that doesn't have one.
I'd say next 5 to 10 years, it'll be as
common. Yeah, I think probably 10 years. Yep.
All right, so let's go on next story.
I think that's cool.
Meet Elena, the girl with three
parents. This is an interesting story, I think, because apparently what happened is she has three parents because they did like the mitochondrial DNA transfer, and they transferred the mitochondria from one egg into another egg.
Her mother said they took it from a third person.
Yeah, transferred the mitochondrial DNA into her mother's egg. Because they were afraid that she had been trying to have her for 10 years, I think it said. And they couldn't pinpoint the reason she wasn't having kids, but that was one of the possibilities, was that there was some sort of defect
with her
mitochondrial DNA.
Right.
So they took the mitochondrial DNA, transferred that into her egg, and then, of course, you used father's sperm to
impregnate. Were inseminated.
And obviously it worked because there's Elena.
Elena, she is what? 10 years old? 12 years old now?
She's got to be older than 10. She looks older than 10.
I'm not a good judge.
12, maybe?
Okay,
so 12. I would go with 12, yeah.
A very healthy looking young lady, though.
Yes.
And
but apparently this is, this has been outlawed, this
really?
Form of fertility treatment, yeah.
In the U.S.?
I think. I don't know. This is a UK story, but I'm assuming it's US too. But they're looking at making it legal again in the UK to prevent diseases and things like that, because apparently a lot of diseases are a result of damage within the mitochondrial DNA. So they're thinking that this is a way that you could stop the spread of certain diseases within genetic bloodlines.
Sure.
They outlawed this. I'm not sure if it was an ethical reason or what, but.
Well, Mackie, so here's what I would take the ethical decision. This is, and they talk about this a little bit in the article. The first thing is.
I think it's up at the beginning where it says it's
outlawed. The super wealthy will want designer babies. I want the blue.
Yes, that's one of the reasons
blah, blah, blah. Perfect. Here's what I want in a baby.
But isn't that what people who oppose all sort of fertility treatments always say?
Sure.
That we're playing God, people are going to want designer babies, blah, blah, blah. I can see that in some people, but
well,
I mean, just as somebody who has known people who have been affected by fertility issues, I think some people just want a healthy baby too.
Right. But here's another part of the ethic discussion is, And maybe this is just me. This is not necessarily my point of view, but this is me kind of playing the devil's advocate of rationalization of why, right? we as a society, or we as a civilization, not a society, we as a civilization, the human race, you know, we are born, we live, we die. And part of our balancing of the economy of those, you know, limited resources, there is an expectation that people eventually die. And we also, to a degree, I think, count on there being calamities. There's basically population control. Mm-hmm. As soon as we start now ensuring that people are born without diseases, mm-hmm. therefore now, whereas maybe only 60% of your population lives to 80, now maybe 90% of your population lives to 80. Okay, I see where you're going.
I mean, because we have that problem now because of medical advances.
Right. I mean, we're all, and we're living longer. I mean,
yes.
It used to be, you know, you're lucky
where you're going 40
years.
I see where you're going.
And it was 60 years. And now we're up to 80.
But by controlling that, aren't we playing God just as much as we are with the fertility treatment?
I agree with you. I mean, because that's the thing. Is it part of,
by trying to control population, aren't we doing just as much harm
of God as I? That is my devil's. That is my conundrum. Because you're right. I think both ways you're playing God. No matter what you say, yes. You're playing God both ways. You're deciding who dies.
Or I mean, are we going to turn into what is it, China, who says everybody can have one child or something?
And this goes back to my.
Do they still have that, by the way?
I think they just this year they loosened up on that.
Really? Yes. Okay.
So I mean, here's where I. My science, my technology background, my spiritual belief system, coupled with my vision for the, you know, human race, is that, you know, again, this goes back to humanity needs to become a space-faring civilization that was no longer restricted to a single planet. Therefore, this talk about population control is a moot point, because now when we reach out to the infinite universe, the human race can then become a seed and pollinate the entire first solar system, then our galaxy, then the universe.
Yeah, didn't we just have a story where we were saying that there would be people living on Mars
in
20 years or so?
Yeah, we'll land on Mars at least by the mid-2030s. Okay. So that's my point. And this is one of those things where we look at it through today's lenses. I'm trying to take that 100 year to 200, 300 year outlook and saying, where's humanity going to be in 300 years?
Now, I mean,
and where's our trajectory for the next 1,000 years?
I'm always so conflicted on this issue too, because I don't think they should have this procedure as a widespread available thing for anybody who wants to use it. I truly do think it should be reserved for people who have undergone genetic testing and things like that, and know that their chances of conceiving a healthy child are slim to none. Yeah. I don't think it should just be for any. I think in order to use these techniques, you should have to undergo extensive genetic counseling. I don't think it should be something you just walk into the fertility clinic and say, hey, I want a blonde haired, blue eyed child.
Right. And
I'm quite happy with our brown hair.
And the reality is, and here's the other reality. Regardless of whether you outlaw something in certain Western countries,
people are going to find a way to do it.
It will happen. Now, you're right. Do we make it easy? No, we don't have to. Will it be done? Do we have to deal with it anyway? I mean, I think a lot of this is, oh, if we outlaw it, we just don't have to deal with the discussion. Well,
no, that's not true, because it still comes up, yeah.
It's going to happen.
I mean, this is what they're dealing with in the UK right now, I think, with this, because they had outlawed it, and now they're trying to bring it back.
And then there's, I mean, here's
that. It's gone, I think, to the lawmakers and stuff like that now in the UK.
And then, you know, imagine if this
I'm not sure. Maybe somebody can let us know. I'm not sure whether this is used in the U.S. or not, because this is a UK
story. I'd say the U.S. is much more... we're anti-science.
Yeah, my guess would be no.
Yeah.
My guess would be no.
Anyway, I mean, there's other, like, you know, what happens if, you know, I've looked at it in the adoption world, right? So what happens if, you know, you have this the parents die. So let's say the parents that raised it, like the mother that has the egg, this father has the sperm. Those two raise this child, but that those parents die. Does then the pay? And there's the will and all that, but you know,
a lot of people don't have a will, though.
Right. Notwithstanding, so would like the grandparents raise this kid, or what would happen if the person that donated their mitochondria would come want to come in and raise this child?
See, I mean, my personal opinion is that that should be an anonymous thing. The mitochondria, you know, when you have people, that it should be an anonymous thing to the. That poses too many ethical problems, I think.
What happens if you find out you are one of these kids and you want to know who your mitochondrial donor was one day when you get 18?
I think a mother and a father who raise you. It's not from a biological standpoint. So.
Right.
We make it too scientific, family, we lose sight of what family is.
Right. Family, to me, it has a bigger meaning.
Yes.
Than simply the nuclear family that we.
That's why it should be anonymous. I mean, it's.
All right. Interesting, though.
It is an interesting story.
And with that, I canceled out I was going to do a story on they were engineering telepathy. Basically.
Oh, you took that story out?
I took that story out because of interest of time. Do you want to put it back? Or do you want to talk about it?
No, we don't have to. I thought that was interesting, too, actually.
Yeah, well, let me bring it back real quick. Let me go to my history. Recently closed. There we go.
Honestly, I thought that story was a load of BS.
Okay.
If you want my opinion.
Scientists prove that telepathic communication is within reach. So the idea is...
Because did you see all the steps that they had to go through just to get... The hello. I mean, they assigned like a binary code to each letter. Then they assigned each binary code to flashes of light. And I mean, it was so time consuming and so, I just don't see how this really, I don't know. I honestly don't see how this worked, so to speak.
Aren't you such a naysayer?
That was just my opinion on it, but maybe we won't talk much about
it. I mean, it's a good, so at the end of the day,
it's interesting, but I honestly don't foresee this in the future. I just don't.
Well, so here's this, my rudimentary, right? Thinking the more I think about
it, it's a form of communication. Like this isn't going to be just to walk up to somebody and read their mind. This is, you have to have some sort of device on that allows you to get communication from this other person who also has this. I mean, it's not just a walk up to somebody and read their mind kind of thing. And there are just so many steps involved that, honestly, there's got to be other forms of communication that are just more simplistic than this.
As a biological layman, right here, let me introduce you to my electrical engineering world. Anytime I pass current through a wire,
yes,
it generates an electromagnetic field that radiates outward, right?
Yes.
So what I understand of the brain, you know, it's basically all these neurons that are firing electricity. That electricity is flowing from neuron to neuron. I would think that it is, in effect, generating an electromagnetic field that passes beyond the borders of the brain,
mm-hmm.
of your head. So again, as a someone who's, I don't want to be confused as being a conspiracy theorist or a new age wacky kind of guy, but you know, the part of me,
I would never confuse you.
What I understand of the electrical principles, when I look at my antenna for my ham radio, I push a current down a wire. I'm radiating out through that antenna all the way around the world, you know, be it my voice or digital packets. So part of me goes, well, okay, this kind of does make sense, because if the brain is just nothing but electrical signals being tossed mm-hmm. out, then to me, and again, maybe I'm wrong because I don't understand biology, I'm throwing out an electromagnetic wave. That wave, I'm the transmitting antenna with my thought. Is it so hard to believe that if a human got close enough, that electromagnetic wave would penetrate through their brain, and is it a way for then you to be able to detect that person's thought?
Aren't doesn't each brain have its own unique set of electromagnetic waves and things like that? So how would you know how to interpret what's coming off of?
I think that's what this research is trying to figure out.
I just think that's
Because part of you're right. Like, so
there's just so many steps involved here that it's not. I don't want to say it's not worth it, because any sort of, you know, ingenuity or innovation, it's all worth it. But it just seems like there's so many more simplistic ways to go about communication than this.
We'll see. I don't know. I mean, because I always thought, like, you know, you're right. Like a deaf person, when I, like, here's the thing. When I think, I'm thinking in my voice. Does that make sense? Like, I'm, as I rationalize, yes. I'm
now that doesn't happen to me all the time.
Think in my voice.
I hate to sound wacky on that, but I hear another voice when I think sometimes.
How do they, what are they hearing in their brain, quote unquote, hearing in their brain when they think?
That's a good question. It's like that whole tree falls in the forest and no one's around to hear it. Does it make a sound?
You know, if you're blind and you don't know, you can, someone can read to you a story or describe
someone can describe, yeah, but how do you know what blue looks like if you've never seen blue?
So how does your brain, that's interesting. True. Anyway.
Yeah,
for a story I wanted to cut out, it is pretty interesting.
It's interesting. It's just, I don't know. There's something that reeks of just not right to me with this story.
Well, right. Do you really need them and wear tinfoil to protect you? I mean, if this research does take off,
Then
read brains. Anyway,
I just don't think it's going to take off. That's my point. Yes, is there a way to communicate? I think yes, I think there is, but I think it's just so cumbersome that it's not going to ever take off.
And that's the final word.
That's just my opinion. I mean, you know, it's just how I feel.
All right, so let me see here.
Did you get my last story on there?
Which was your last story?
About the doctors using art to...
Obviously, I didn't.
I know you didn't.
I am such a bad host. Let me go figure this out here. It's
on the show notes page.
Bookmarks, history. Where's my history? Show notes.
Should be like Art News Daily. It's the last link on there. We can skim that one really quick too, but I thought it was interesting. So, Arts Journal, yes.
I did not see that one.
That's because I don't put descriptions next to...
Yep.
Sorry about that. Basically, the gist of it is there is a growing trend now with the medical profession. You have to click on where it says the Wall Street Journal down at the bottom.
Ew.
Yes.
Ew, WSJ.
Basically, there's a growing trend now for medical students and doctors to study art in an attempt to become better doctors and notice things, make better diagnoses, things like that. In this picture, they talk about the doctors gravitate to the guy who has a swollen knee. And they're using certain art to say, okay, what's wrong with this person by looking at the art.
So we rely on the artist actually doing very realistic and not being interpretive.
Yes. This is more of a, what would you call it? Like, I hate to use the word fine art, but...
Back when art was boring. I'm sorry. Yeah, but I would say classical art.
Yes. Yes.
A portraiture.
Yes.
A landscape.
Because what they talk about with the thing, the swollen knee, I think it was it?
Yeah. Looks like a Roman Greek.
Talk about is that he knew how to paint a knee correctly because he had other works of art where he painted correct knees. But in this specific one, he painted this guy with the swollen knee.
Right.
So the doctors were split on whether, okay, does this guy have osteoarthritis or does he have late stage gout?
But so basically they're using these pictures to show, why don't they just go photograph people today with real diseases and just put those in a book with no description and just say, you know, like a flashcard. Like, here's a picture, but on the back is what it really fits with. Why use?
I think they probably do that. It's just, I think they're using this as a way for doctors to hone their attention to detail a little better.
I think it sounds like just a way to go look at the art museum and get out of the office for a bit. I mean, I get it. I think it's cool. Don't get me wrong. I just don't see why we couldn't do this today with photographs that are more realistic and train doctors. Why? What about it is about a painting from the 18th
Because if you give somebody a photograph of somebody who definitely has something, there is no subjectivity there. There's no way to say, okay, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. You're not using your critical thinking enough.
I can dig it. I can buy that.
Say, well, maybe this person has this, maybe that. You know, it's such a definitive diagnosis when you're looking at somebody's picture, a photograph.
So basically, to me, it sounds like this is like a story of let's get back to basics. Like,
yes, exactly.
Yeah, we've got all this whiz bang technology, MRIs,
and that's what scans. That's the story actually talks about that, about how doctors are using technology nowadays to diagnose people, but this is forcing them to take a step back and actually look at some of the details, and even things like MRIs and stuff, look at the details of the MRI to see where the real diagnosis lies.
Okay.
Because unfortunately, people are misdiagnosed with things every day.
Okay, I'm cool.
I just thought it was a cool story to get some art into the podcast, because I don't think we talk about enough art-related news.
I agree. This is a way of mixing
yes.
it all together.
Exactly.
You're good at that. All right. Cool. I like it. So the last thing we wanted to do was
look top back five at 2014.
I tried to do science, technology, engineering, art, and math.
Yeah. So this isn't necessarily the top five stories in relevant order. This is sort of a category breakdown.
I looked for like top math stories of 2014. And the only thing I could come back to with some proofs and theories that
there's not so much math. But the math is in everything.
But you're right, yes. But with that said, there were some stories that I kind of thought were worth mentioning again.
Now, are these all stories that we've covered?
Yes.
I noticed that a couple of them.
I'm pretty sure they are all ones we did cover. So the first one is
a science story.
The scientists have created "quote unquote" alien DNA.
Now we're not going to talk about these stories like we do the other ones. You're just going to give a quick little synopsis.
Quick synopsis
right
that basically we now have synthetic DNA, which means now we can create hyper personalized medicines.
Yes.
And in theory, you could create alien life that doesn't exist here on planet Earth.
Okay.
In theory. Technology cool. story, the FAA approved the first commercial drone flights in the US. Mm-hmm. This was given back, in June, to BP.
Before Lisa. Before Lisa joined the podcast.
They gave it to this, I guess it was like a license or permission to BP. They're doing things to do, obviously, up in Alaska with the environment, with oil research, and looking at migrations of animals or whatever. That was cool. The big one just here in the last couple of weeks.
Yes, definitely remember this.
There's
one.
Two with I call them engineering stories.
It's that
both space related.
It's perfect.
This, everything is going perfect. God help us on the future missions. Orion, the United States' replacement for the space shuttle program, had its first test flight.
And it went extremely well.
Almost too well. But yes, it went very well. And it's now they brought the capsule back, and it's down back in Florida finally.
So you think this is what's going to get us to Mars, right?
This is what's going to take us to Mars.
Cool.
That's the plan by mid-2030s. The other big space engineering story was the Rosetta Comet mission, mm-hmm. where and this one is a .. to be continued story. So
this is the one that the European Space Agency did that weird video on, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right.
From the guy
I remember that, yes.
Game of Thrones.
That was pretty wild.
It was pretty wild. I don't know why it's not refreshing right now. But so real quick, so basically, for the first time ever, humanity, we launched a probe. It went out. It successfully made orbit. I hit refresh, so hopefully it'll come back. We successfully orbited the comet for a couple of days. Then we launched. There it is. A landing probe called a lander called Philae, Philae, which I'm assuming is how you pronounce it. It did. How do I put this? It did its function. It landed on the comet. It may, we think, now have had a bit of a rough landing. Okay. It may have skidded a couple times. So right now, this is a picture from the lander, and basically, imagine like you're laying on your back and you're looking up, and you've got like a cliff overhanging you.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of got lodged in this cliff. So this over here is space. That's looking out into space. Mm-hmm. This is it looking up the at cliff. This cliff. Okay.
Gotcha.
So right now it's not getting as much direct sunlight as it needs, but here's the cool thing. Because comets have these weird, funky orbits and rotations and spins, around March of this year,
mm-hmm.
it should be getting enough sunlight that it will be able to fire back up and do some stuff.
Okay, cool.
So come March, this is
the we'll get some new pictures come March. Okay, that sounds good.
But successful nonetheless.
And the art last story, but not least?
Second to last.
Okay.
This is a real quick one. We talked about art a little bit. Twice this year,
I don't remember doing this one.
This was February.
Okay.
This is way before Lisa.
Yeah.
You know, back in World War II, the Nazis made a you know, they pilfered a lot, stole mm-hmm. a lot of art. A lot of other non-Nazis, people that were not sympathetic to the Nazi cause, took art and hid it away. And then over time, you know, even the honest art got stolen, and mm-hmm. people needed money and made deals.
And people probably just forgot things were there.
Well, so there's two caches found this past year. One included 1,400 pieces of artwork.
Oh wow!
In this one guy's house, and this art was, and it, we're talking.
How
like,
would you even fit?
We're talking in like that house. Monets and Picassos.
Oh wow!
Not just right, like okay. Mike's art. So, and this was
not just my watercolor paintings, right?
Right. Earlier, maybe late 2013. They found another secret big stash of art. Over the next couple of years, as these things get redistributed back to the rightful owners, there's a chance to see Picassos and Monets.
How do you know who owns them? How do you know who the rightful owners are if these are all just stored in a house somewhere?
I'm assuming there would have been records. I don't know. I don't know how you do it. I'm not an arts historian, but the point of the end story is that once they figure out who they go to, I mean, some of them were pilfered from state museums. So we know.
Yes.
That
okay. I got to, that. But some of them, if they were just taken from a family's
house, right.
Home or something like that, you know, they may not have had a record that they owned certain kind of painting.
But bottom line is over the next couple of years, as these things get resolved,
we'll have more art. So we'll have to go to the, National Gallery of Art in the coming years. Yes. Okay. Went there this past summer. It was quite nice. Yes.
Yes, it was.
Quite nice.
The Portraiture Gallery. Portraitures. Anyway.
I'm more of the
landscapes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I am too. Because I see enough ugly human faces at the time. I got one. So I don't see any more. All right. So the last story of the year, the Supreme Court delivered the fatal wound that we were waiting for to patent trolls.
And I remember this story. This was one of the first stories I did. I think it was. In the early
So early they ruled
days of my podcasting.
In a case called Alice versus CLS Bank. Basically the gist is, you know, there are banking principles that have existed for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And just because you now encoded those you've taken these algorithms and actually wrote them in a piece of software, mm-hmm. a particular implementation, doesn't mean you own the right to the process as a whole. And this is one of the things that patent trolls have been, you know, buying up patents and then just going out, and anybody that's on anything remotely related to this patent. And granted, a lot of these patents should never have been awarded in the first place. Basically, they're just suing people to nickel and dime them.
Okay.
Supreme Court finally came down and said, no, you can't just patent something that has been done forever just because you wrote it in a particular piece of software.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as that case hit at the Supreme Court, a bunch of lower courts threw out a bunch of cases based on that ruling. So
okay.
It's really, knock on wood here, put a stagger in patent trolls, and hopefully as we go forward, there's some more issues related to patent trolls, but this was a big one.
Okay.
And hopefully it sets a precedence for the years to come. All right. With that, let me edit that out.
We've kind of ran over time wise today.
But we have done good though. It's beautiful.
Yeah, we've covered a lot in our time.
So my hope for this year, so make New Year's resolutions for the podcast.
Okay.
We do the main podcast every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping to do in between those weeks now going forward. And maybe you could contribute as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'll throw this on you. I want to do more tutorial videos. So like I'm working on,
and it's not digits. That I wouldn't mind contributing. It's just that I'm not sure exactly unless people want a tutorial on how to knit. Oh, you didn't show your gauntlet.
Oh, I did it here. Give me that.
Yeah.
So basically what I want to do is
does this do go with
some
it?
Electronics tutorial projects.
Does this go with it?
No, it's separate.
No. Okay.
So one thing I am working on right now, and there's already there's a couple of YouTube videos up, but I'll just show it for people that
you should definitely do more tutorials because, and I don't know, have you ever plugged your Google Help Outs on here?
Yeah, I think so. I do Google
Help Outs. You do Google Help Outs, and you're very successful at that.
Doing pretty it's
everybody who meets with you seems to enjoy it.
So this is my why I want to do more.
Yes.
Sort of, so
I knitted it.
Knit this part because I can't do that worth a crap. And I did the electronics and the sewing. So there's conductive thread. This is a an Arduino, the Flora model, a little RGB LED, and a little magnetometer, basically a digital compass. And so the idea for this thing is if I'm facing north, the LED glows white.
It lights up.
If I go face to the west, it glows red. So each direction glows a different color. So the idea is, you know, and eventually this is obviously.
And I think this would be good for people who ride bicycles out on the street and things like that to show that they're turning.
Turning,
and things
yeah.
Like
you
that.
Can
yeah.
Do things where if I detect this motion, I make it blink. It
flashes the light, yeah.
Was it? Yeah, right. I'm turning right. That's turning left. This is stopping.
I can't say. I'm not sure about that. But
so the idea is.
I think that's a cool application of that.
It's a prototype. So obviously what I would, in a final product, do a custom circuit board, make this all look like a really tiny, probably the size of a quarter, and embed this into a glove, and then a little battery pack with it. And then, so in theory, if you're out skiing, or if you're out backpacking or whatever, you don't want to dig out your phone or your phone is dead or you want to, you know, you don't know how to use an analog compass. Or my thinking was really for like skiing is because you're going so fast, and you have your hands already preoccupied. You really want a quick, just
know which way you're going.
Which, like if I get to a path and it splits, do I want to go to the north? Do I want to go west?
Mm-hmm.
This gives a quick, easy way to do that. So I'm hoping to get this into like a final real assembled product.
Mm-hmm.
In 2015.
Yeah, that's cool.
So thank you for your help, though.
Thank you for asking me.
All right.
Not sure quite what I would do tutorial videos on because
knitting, crocheting, whatever this is.
Yeah. Yes. Knitting.
You're painting. You've started painting.
I have started painting again. I'm still in the very early stages of that, but I have started painting again.
So there's stuff. We'll figure it out. 2015.
You're definitely the tutorial and the help out guy.
You will get you there. You will get there.
I'll get there maybe, but for right now, I think that's your niche.
I appreciate it. So with that, I guess it's time to end it.
Mm-hmm.
We have gone long.
Yes.
You can find out more. Always visit steampowerpodcast.com. There's links to the Twitter, Google Plus, Patreon, Cafe Press, SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, everything else under the sun that we do. My Mouser, so I did a project for Mouser Electronics. I called it Snail Mail Meets the 21st Century.
Yes, yes, I think you shared that.
That's finally published. So cool. If you head over to mouser.com/blog. It's a two-part thing. The main article split over two parts. The first part's up now.
Yes, they should definitely check out your Mouser work because you do excellent blogs.
There's some good stuff.
You really
there.
Do. Yep.
And in the weeks coming, there'll be some supplemental blogs that explain some.
Can't wait for the cat toy project.
And we're working potentially on a cat toy project that I won't say anything else more about, but we'll leave to say that it involves.
We need that.
It involves lasers.
Yes, we need that in our lives with our cat too.
So more hopefully in the next couple weeks on that. Anyway, with that, do you got anything else?
Nope.
All right. So again, head up the website, steampowerpodcast.com. You can find the links, leave us feedback on the Google Plus page or tweet at us or whatever. And with that, hope and wish everyone a
happy 2015.
Happy 2015. May it be steamy and prosperous. And with that, that's it. So thank you all very much for listening. And until next time, stay quirky
and keep it steamy.
Later.